This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, Building the New Normal, from safety on our streets to food in our fridges. America's CEOs answering calls for change from their employees. AT&T Executive Chairman Randall Stephenson.
Never in my career experienced anything like what I've experienced over the last 3 weeks.
And how the Business Roundtable, the mouthpiece for the C-suite, is thinking about calls to defund the police.
Does policing need to change? Yes. I think the data is in, and the answer is yes. We're going to have to think, what do we want the police force to do? Where should they be involved? Today, we have them involved in issues ranging from mental health to addiction. Should they be there?
Plus, the essential work of grocery delivery is booming due to COVID-19. Fresh Direct CEO David McInerney.
The demand has been tremendous. It started in late February, early March, and it's just, frankly, intensified throughout this entire period.
It's Wednesday, July 1st, 2020, halfway down. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin, and welcome to July, everybody. This is the first day of the second half of the year. Markets just had their best 3 months in decades. The Dow saw its best quarterly performance since 1987. The S&P actually saw its best performance since 1999. And then the Nasdaq, it had its best gain since 1999. It ended the quarter up more than 30%. Also, take a look at small caps. The Russell 2000 gaining 25% just since April 1st. That is its best quarterly gain that we've seen since the first quarter of 1991. But that's because the first quarter, as you probably remember, really stunk up the place. The Dow is coming off of its worst first half of the calendar year since the 2008 financial crisis. And the S&P is notching its worst first half in a decade, and it is still down about 4% on the year. Andrew?
And we'll see whether this market has more to roll.
I guess you could say the Nasdaq, guys, is partying like it's 1999. That would be we could play that, because that was 19. That was a song, right? And so
yeah,
that was the best.
It was, but remember what happened after that.
Bad hangover, very bad in 1999. And we got
And also going into it, we hadn't had that Well, and Becky said it. I mean, we sort of had this, we're coming off of this terrible moment. The 1999, we weren't coming off a terrible moment. We were on this sort of crazy pendulum swing.
We had been on a tear for a long time.
The terrible moment was infinity multiples for pets.com, because they had a nice puppet. That lady's reborn somewhere else, I guess.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, these racist cars have got to go.
After a month of nationwide protests sparked by the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, lawmakers in the House of Representatives have passed legislation in his name. The George Floyd Justice in Policing Act of 2020, addressing criminal police conduct, banning chokeholds and no-knock warrants, among other measures, was proposed by House Democrats and passed by the skin of its teeth.
The ayes have it. The yeas and nays are ordered. Members will record their votes by electronic device.
Three Republicans crossed party lines to vote in favor of the bill, and it's now on the way to the Senate, although there's not much hope for its survival there. This legislation is part of an ongoing stalemate in Congress regarding police reform. Even getting to the House floor was tough. A week prior to the vote, the House Judiciary Committee debated the Democratic legislation and the Republicans proposed amendments to it for 12 hours. Congressman Cedric Richmond of Louisiana spoke to his colleagues candidly during those 12 tense hours.
Mr. Chairman, let me just start by saying I am absolutely sitting here offended and angry as hell. As a black male who went to the fifth best public high school in the country, who was a victim of excessive force, who has a black son, who has worries that you all don't. And to my colleagues, especially the ones that keep introducing amendments that are a tangent and a distraction from what we're talking about, you all are white males, you never lived in my shoes, and you do not know what it's like to be an African-American male. And all I'm saying is, if you are opposed to this legislation, let's just have the vote. But please do not come in this committee room and make a mockery of the pain that exist in my community. People are dying as we talk. So I am not interested am moving at a snail's pace. I am not interested in a watered-down bill that mandates nothing.
A week later, as I mentioned, the bill passed while state and city legislatures prepared to vote on similar reforms, New York City, for example, and the state of Michigan. All the while, President Trump has vocally opposed nationwide calls to defund the police. His press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, just this week.
President Trump stands against defunding our brave police officers, caving to mob rule, and cancel culture which seeks to erase our history.
Moving from Washington to Wall Street, CEOs, for their part, are coming into their own roles in pursuing social changes that many of their employees are pushing for. The Business Roundtable is a coalition of about 200 CEO members who lead over 15 million employees and generate over $7 trillion in annual revenues. Speaking for those CEOs and helping to coordinate their efforts for anti-racist progress is our next guest, Randall Stephenson. He has been AT&T CEO since 2007 until today. He is now executive chairman, and July 1st marks the first day of his successor, John Stankey, in the CEO role. Stephenson is no stranger to speaking out about injustice. In 2016, at an AT&T event, he vocally defended the Black Lives Matter movement in the wake of the fatal shooting of Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and the subsequent protests.
Tolerance is for cowards. Being tolerant requires nothing from you but to be quiet and to not make waves, holding tightly to your views and judgments without being challenged. Do not tolerate each other. Work hard, move into uncomfortable territory, and understand each other.
Here's Joe Kernan kicking off the conversation with AT&T Executive Chairman Randall Stephenson today on Squawk Box.
The nation's top CEOs are joining together to push for policing policy reforms. The Business Roundtable just out this morning with recommendations for Congress, and the group wants lawmakers to act before the summer's out. Randall Stephenson is the chair of the BRT Committee on Racial Equality. Randall, thanks for being here. We were together not too long ago on the show talking about some similar things, and you're not new to this whole cause.
Well, I think, Joe, good morning, first of all, but I think what's different this time is people recognize and accept we got a problem. And people, the American public, I mean, the polling shows American public is ready for something to change. They're ready for legislative action. And so you have folks in the House, you have folks in the Senate who are working this issue. They have legislation that is actually passed in the House. And so now the time is ripe to get some legislation passed that could actually produce not just kind of figurative reform, but real reform. And there are ideas on the table for legislation that, if passed, would produce reform. Now, if you note some frustration by people now that maybe it's not going to happen because the Senate will not even get a bill on the floor to debate, that's a problem, because I think the time is ripe. And then the BRT, we have said this is the moment. We need to get ready. We need to get our position established, and we need to push to see if we can get legislation done and get some real reform done. So everything's set. The table's set. Now we need the Senate to get to work and put a bill on the floor and debate it.
I mean, the more sectors, the more groups that get involved, the better, obviously. But I just, can you make the case that this is the Business Roundtable or businesses that has to do the heavy lifting? I mean, it's happening organically just across the entire population, I think. And the point keeps being made in some of this, you know, some of the background, that the Business Roundtable was able to help with tax reform, and that you guys can motivate politicians to move on tax reform. Is that the same thing as trying to change it, something from the ground up culturally? Is that really the role of business? Although we welcome everyone trying, but it's not the same thing as getting Congress to move on tax reform. It just doesn't seem that simple, Randall.
Well, look, I've been doing this a long time, 13 years as CEO, 38 years at AT&T. Joe, I have never in my career experienced anything like what I've experienced over the last 3 weeks in terms of employees, broad base number of employees that are saying, what are you doing? What are we as a company doing? We have these values. You post them on the wall. Are we going to act in accordance with these values to value equality? And And there is a real concern, not just among our black employees right now, but among a broad base of employees. And that's what's happening across America right now, is Americans are saying this needs to be dealt with. Candidly, it's not being dealt with yet. It is stuck. And so can the business community lend our voice to this? And do we have a voice to lend to this? Is it relevant for the business community to step in? And it, look, I got to tell you, if we don't have justice for all citizens, if there's a segment of our citizenry that is precluded from just treatment, then you're not going to have tranquility. You're not going to have peace. You're not going to have civility. That's just not good for anybody, whether it's business or whether it's the communities in general. So we believe strongly business has a role to play here and that our voice is relevant. There are a lot of areas that we are not experts on. We won't pretend to be experts on them. There are a lot of areas where we do think our voice is relevant and we have things to lend to this conversation. And so where that's the case, we're going to lend our voice. And one of those areas is, you know, we've got provisions in our police law that haven't even been legislated. They're just functions of court rulings over a number of years. This is the kind of thing legislators need to legislate on these actions. They need to put in place formal legislation, debate it in front of the American people, let the messy work of democracy play its course, and pass laws to deal with this.
I mean, as I said, all hands on deck, and it's welcome for business. But how does business have it? Can money leverage politicians to act? And is there a way that business can somehow use that leverage to what, where the common person on the street can't get a politician to do something and business might be able to? Do you see some actual method where that would work, Randall?
Well, I wouldn't say it's money. I would say that the businesses and the folks on the BRT, we all have access to people in Congress. We have ready access where we can voice these issues very directly. I've spent a lot of time over the last 2 days with congresspeople, specifically Tim Scott of South Carolina, who I got to tell you, after having spent the last 2 days talking to him, he has put a very reasonable starting point. It doesn't have all of the issues addressed that some on the Democratic Party would like to see addressed, but he's got a reasonable starting point. And you spend time talking to Tim Scott, you see a willingness to entertain amendments of all kinds to address many of the issues that folks on the other side of the aisle want addressed. But he needs it on the floor to debate. So business can lend their voice with Congress people directly. And we also, look, we are very active at the state and local level. And we have the ability, and the BRT, you should assume, will use its resources to begin to run ads and direct communication to encourage our congresspeople to step up and pass legislation here.
Yeah. You know, all politics is local, as they say. And in terms of you know, the way who AT&T hires, who they elevate to management positions, who AT&T puts on the board or any company, you need to walk the walk as well, Randall. Do you think that's being done by American business?
I think American business has made a lot of progress, Joe. I think the events of the last 3 weeks have caused all of us to pause and say, is it time to step up our game? Is there more that can be done? You know, we at AT&T, we've been very diligent at ensuring we have good representation of African-Americans on our board. And I think it starts there. And if you don't get that part right, then it doesn't flow down into the organization. But is there more that AT&T can do? Absolutely. John Stankey, our new CEO, he and I have had this conversation. In fact, he has had a conversation with the board already on what more can we do. And so there's a lot of effort going around, you know, how do we step up our game? And some of the traditional diversity and inclusion efforts that we have been engaged in, that's probably not enough now. So we're going to have to take another look at this.
When Gail King asked you,
Randall, I understand you're stepping down July 1st.
And I'm being replaced by a gentleman named John Stankey.
Who is another, Randall, who's another white man. That, it seems like that would have been an opportunity to have a woman or a person of color.
Fair challenge.
And you said that was a fair question. Do you think that's a fair question?
Sure, it's a fair question. I think it's a fair question to ask of any senior leadership role at AT&T. Did you look at diverse candidates? Did you evaluate diverse candidates for the CEO role? I can tell you very specifically, the board went through an elaborate process in terms of the CEO selection process before they selected John Stankey. It looked at a number of candidates outside of AT&T, and there was a very good slate of diverse candidates. And so when they put everything into the decision matrix, you know, they landed on John Stankey. But I think it's a perfectly fair question. I think the next executive position that comes up in AT&T, you should assume that the board and John Stankey will ask, are there diverse candidates? Are we looking hard? Are we being aggressive enough to identify diverse candidates who could fill these roles? So, yeah, I think it's fair.
So, Randall, the police reform and how we go about it, you can imagine how this issue just becomes really a hot button issue for both sides depending on where you stand. We're seeing some increase in crime in certain areas in New York City. There's worries that you've heard about the broken window idea, that you can't ignore broken windows because then it becomes, you know, it starts mushrooming. Are you worried that if we start moving resources from police departments to other areas, are you worried that we could see crime come back in certain areas and in trying to do good, that it could actually be counterproductive to what we're in and for the people that we're trying to help? Because we know where a lot of crime is. It's in some of the areas that you know, that we worry about in big cities.
Yeah, Joe, do you worry about it? Of course you do. Public safety. I mean, that is the whole point of policing. And we heard Nancy Pelosi speak yesterday at the BRT, and she talked about this requirement that we address and that we are attentive and very diligent about public safety. And so, does policing need to change? Yes, I think the data is in, and the answer is yes. The policing process needs to change, and how police interact with the communities, and particularly the Black communities, that has to change. This is why you need a legislative approach to this, Joe, because if you just, you know, kind of throw caution to the wind here, you will have chaos. You have to build a bridge to a new policing environment. And that's what the legislators need to address, so that we don't just try to go from point A to point B without a bridge in between, because without a bridge, you do have chaos. And we think that's why legislators need to step up.
Well, Randall, do you see if let's say that you just en masse were to take funding and move 20% to community funding instead, what if there are fewer police, should there be the same number of police or even, you know, increased numbers where you need them doing their job differently? Or do you think we should have less police? And if you were in a police force right now and you were watching what was happening around, I don't know whether you'd really want to be a policeman much longer, but would you? It just seems like we need to worry about both sides of that.
Of course you do, Joe. You know, so I'm a businessman. And if, you know, a few years back, you know, 10 years, right when I took over this job 13 years ago, we said, look, the world is moving to wireless. We need to reallocate capital. We need to reallocate talent. We need to reallocate resources to our wireless business. And that means you're going to have to, quote, defund the wireline business. Joe, we didn't just the next day stop putting capital and cost and customer care into our wireline business. We built a transition plan on how do you get the capital and the people reallocated so that you don't destroy one as you build up the future. And that's where we are in policing. We're going to have to think, what do we want the police force to do? Where should they be involved? Today, we have them involved in issues ranging from mental health to addiction. Should they be there? If you just pull the rug out and say, tomorrow, no, okay, you will have public safety issues. We need to begin to train police officers on how to deal with these situations, and over time, have the people best suited to address mental health and addiction issues address those. But you can't just pull the rug out tomorrow, because you will have, I mean, significant problems. But we need training for our officers on how to deal with these situations, how to de-escalate violent encounters in these situations. And so you have to build this bridge. That's what legislation's about, is how do you build a bridge from here to there?
I just wonder that with what the way the country is, and you know, we have an election coming up, things can obviously change. But if you can't get Senator Scott's proposals to even be considered, how far apart are Democrats and Republicans on what needs to be done with such a contentious and you know, emotional issue as trying to reform the police in this country? How's it going to happen, Randall, between you mentioned Nancy Pelosi, between Nancy Pelosi and someone on the other side, like a Mitch McConnell or someone that's a Republican, we're going to be frustrated again as things don't come together.
I find myself frustrated now. That's why the BRT is engaged, because, you know, look, we as business people think this is something that needs to happen just for a good functioning society. And so, you know, step one is, can you get a bill passed out of one of the chambers of Congress? House, they've done it. You know, I kind of give a nod to what the House has done. That bill is not crazy. That bill addresses a lot of fundamental issues, really important issues that need to be addressed with police reform. You know, should all of those be passed into legislation? I think that's subject to debate. That's why you have a Senate. The Senate needs to now debate their version of what this would look like and get this into a conference and begin to do the hard work of legislating. Unfortunately, and I don't want to be partisan on this, but unfortunately, we have Democrats who have said we won't even debate the issues. The Democrats have some very valid points that need to be publicly debated. The issue of qualified immunity, immunity for police officers, that is a big issue to be addressed by a Congress. But we can't even have a debate on immunity. And I actually was surprised yesterday when I spoke to Tim Scott. He has said that he is open to some alternatives that would address the core issues of immunity, which is, you know, how do people who have been victims of police misconduct get compensated for that? Because of this immunity, there is no avenue for people to be compensated for improper treatment by police. He's prepared to discuss, are there avenues we can take to address that? But this idea of immunity, I mean, that's a big issue. And there's a lot of people that I've spoken to that are in the public policy domain. They're nonpartisan people who say there are some serious incentive issues attached to immunity, and it needs a public hearing. And right. So, you know, that's why we're challenging the Senate. Get to work. Let's take the Scott bill. Let's begin to debate it. Let's debate immunity. Let the public determine what immunity of police officers should look like by virtue of the ballot box. We should have politicians setting policy, not courts. This issue has been established by the courts. The courts have written the law around police immunity. Well, I think we ought to have a debate on this.
Yeah, important issues. I wish you could just say it. Police need to be part of the solution. They should never be part of the problem, because it's a solution that is desperately needed in so many parts of the country and in so many cities. So
yeah, no, nobody hates a bad cop more than a good cop, right?
Right.
The good cops, that's what we're trying to protect here as well. Make sure that we're giving them the tools they need and that they're not all being painted with a brush of bad cop because of a few bad actors. So we need reform, Joe. And okay. We're really calling on the Senate to step it up. Let's get it done.
Okay. See you later. Thanks, Randall.
Next on Squawk Pod, online grocer Fresh Direct is seeing a huge surge in new shoppers during the coronavirus safer at home orders. But longtime customer Becky Quick kept her delivery spot.
We saw things like 600% increases in customers coming in and shopping the store, you know, which was daunting at first, but I think they did a great job of reacting to it.
Fresh Direct CEO David McInerney, when we come back. This is Squawk Pod with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Here's Becky.
Online grocer Fresh Direct introducing two-hour express delivery as a response to consumer demand during the coronavirus pandemic. David McInerney is the CEO and co-founder of Fresh Direct, and he joins us right now from the company's headquarters in the Bronx. And David, first of all, I have to say thank you to you and your staff for keeping my family afloat during the pandemic. I've been a Chef's Table member since 2011, and you guys were a saving grace through the pandemic. I know it was not easy. I know you've had a huge surge in customer demand, but I do have to say your staff was wonderful and made it so that I didn't have to go to the grocery store a lot. I think I got one of the coveted slots, though, because I'm a regular member and because I've had weekly deliveries for a very long time. I do know a lot of other people out there were frustrated because they wanted to get deliveries. What kind of demand did you see during the pandemic, and how did you handle it?
Good morning, and thank you for being a customer. The demand has been tremendous. It started in late February, early March, and it's just, frankly, intensified throughout this entire period. To a point where I'd say now is really, really our strongest point of demand. We saw some interesting shifts. We deliver to three major cities, right? So northeast of New York, Philadelphia, D.C. Cities were always strong for us. Where we saw the big growth is probably where you are, is out in the suburbs. Yes, it's been challenging, but I think the team has done a remarkable job of rising to the challenge and really, we're getting to a point now where we're capable of taking all of it. And we saw things like 600% increases in customers coming in and shopping the store, which was daunting at first, but I think they did a great job of reacting to it.
Yeah, I mean, as a customer, I did notice some of the bumps along the way, and I'm sure it had to do with just so many people wanting so much from you all at once. I saw there were different times where you all put limits, whether it was for a $750 limit per order, or maybe it was 50 items that you were allowed to have at 1.2, as much as you wanted of those 50 SKUs, but 50 different SKUs that you could have. Normally, I would have multiple deliveries during the week from you, but obviously because of demand, I just had the one. So you must have been seeing some real issues. And I just wonder, what was that? Was it trying to deal with workers and protect them, trying to just deal with the flood of people coming in? And how prepared do you feel at this point?
So we feel very prepared now. And yes, it was all of the above. What was interesting was it wasn't just an increase of consumers coming in and customers coming in, but it was how much they wanted to buy. And because the delivery, just as you said, because the delivery slots were tight, people were buying more and more. And it got to the point where I was anecdotally hearing stories about somebody who got a spot would buy food for all of their neighbors on their floor in their building. And that's why that was sort of the magic ticket for us, which was to put a limit on it. And by putting the limit on it, it allowed us to get actually more throughput through the building. And we also did limit the SKUs a little bit. I think it was our thought at the time was it was more important to let people have access to a T-bone steak or a porterhouse steak as opposed to nine different varieties of the porterhouse steak. So we said, okay, let's have one available. But, you know, the grass-fed, the organic, the prime, the dry age, we're going to limit it down to one. And that worked well for us.
Yeah, I appreciated that more than the dollar limit, too. David, just in terms of the food supply chain and some of the issues we've seen in the country at this point, what issues did you all come upon in terms of what you could get access to? And are there any problems with that at this point, or has that all worked its way out?
You know, for us, it was not our biggest challenge, but a lot of it has to do with the nature of our business as well. We are very heavily focused and fresh and weighted on fresh food. So it's the meat, the produce, the seafood, the deli, the cheeses, and the kitchen, the prepared foods. That's what most of our customers are buying from us. And when you think about those different categories, we have really, really tight relationships with all of the growers and the manufacturers and the farmers and the ranchers. So communicating with them regularly, giving them an insight into what we were seeing, allowed them to plan accordingly for us. And as a result, that was not our biggest challenge. And, you know, from everything we're hearing today, they're on really solid footing.
What was your biggest challenge?
The biggest challenge was dealing with trying to catch up with the demand on a daily basis. It was really tough to forecast. We would see orders coming in, and if we had a certain amount of orders, we estimated that the basket size would be a certain amount. And in reality, the basket size became a lot larger. And that caused us to shift around, you know, operationally. We're moving people into different departments, adding on more trucks, more drivers. That's really what it was. It was really pushing the envelopes of how much food we could get out of each building. And we were fortunate because the building that we're in now is sort of a massive state-of-the-art facility that we just completed about a year ago. And we really just completed burning it in about a year ago. And that allowed us enormous opportunities in terms of flexing up, you know, to take the increase in demand without having to scale up the labor as much.
I do realize that you all are able to offer a 2-hour delivery now. This is the new thing that you're announcing. I would imagine that there's huge demand for that, too. And even at this point, I have a hard time getting slots for multiple deliveries during the week. How will you be able to kind of manage both of those things, where you continue to offer and open up slots and then also make sure that you can deliver, for some people at least, in these urban areas within 2 hours?
Yeah, so First, it starts with what is the consumer promise that we're making? What is the offering? And for us, it started with next day. And then we launched the same day where people could order in the morning and then at night. And then we evolved our thinking even more to say, well, actually, consumers evolved their expectations even more to say that they wanted it right away. And that's really what prompted us to get that going. But it was also about enabling you, the consumer, to live the life that you want to live, which is probably not just one delivery a week where you get multiple a week. And by adding the 2 hour, it actually allows us to leverage the different buildings that we have. We have the main building, but it's very much a hub and spoke model that we've got where we've got the main building and then we filter out to smaller buildings that can do the on-demand. And that's something I think that's likely the direction that both will be going and I think consumers will be going, which is I don't want to plan super far ahead and I want it quickly. And in this case, the variety is less than you would see at the Fresh Direct site, but it's enough to get what you need, mm-hmm. right? It should satisfy whatever it is that you're looking for that day.
Hey, David, everybody in the grocery business is trying to do what you all are doing right now. Maybe the most notable is Amazon trying to take over Whole Foods. I've tried the service. It's not as good. And because it's such a high demand issue right now, I just wonder if what you're doing and the success you're having with it makes you a target for another company that would like to try and get better at this. Have you had companies reach out that would like to potentially buy you?
I mean, yes, we are in a hot sector, right? So online food is the topic of conversation with everybody. I think we internally are focused on our customers and growing our business now. That's really where we put our focus and all of our attention.
You mentioned the new building, and I was a customer through that, too. That definitely added some hiccups and led to some frustrations. Are you past the point of those growing pains, or with all of this new demand for customers coming in the door, do you risk running into some of those issues again? Do you need to build another new building already?
Yes, we are past the growing pains, and yes, there were growing pains, and we're entirely past them. If you had asked me a year ago, I probably would have had a different answer, but today I am really, really happy that we went through all of the effort that we did to get this building as tight as it is right now to allow us to really grow. And yes, we will be expanding and we'll ultimately need more buildings. I think our short-term goal is to capture the Northeast corridor. And then if we were to go into other areas, we're probably thinking about building something similar.
Hey, David, I know it's a different business, but maybe an adjacent business. I don't know if you've been following Uber in talks now to buy Postmates. At one point, they've been in talks to buy Grubhub. How similar are those businesses? Obviously, those are not profitable businesses yet. You're profitable, right?
So we're private, so we don't comment. What I would say is that I am happy with where we are, and I'm very happy at what the short-term future looks like, too.
Do you see, though, those businesses, the Ubers and the Lyfts of the like, being able to ever get into the delivery business in the way you are?
You know, I don't know. And I probably shouldn't opine on it because that's really not my area of expertise. I'm fairly comfortable in commenting on what we do. I'm a fan of our delivery model. I'm a fan of the way we, you know, the way we have our routes and depots set up. And I think it is really, really important to control the cold chain all the way through, which is what we do. You know, all of our trucks are refrigerated. And when it gets down to the quality of the food, that's really important. So from the time it leaves the farm, it's refrigerated. It comes into our buildings, it's refrigerated, and it goes on our trucks, and that's refrigerated. And I think that's a really important component of online food and when it relates to quality.
David, thank you for your time today. And again, thanks to your team.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Squawk Pod will be right back. That's Squawk Pod for today. Thanks for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern and subscribe to Squawk Pod. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen. And if you like what you hear on Squawk Pod, tell a friend. Sharing is caring. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.